This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with Rhode Island GOP gubernatorial candidate, Giovanni Ferosi. Ferosi is most well known for his tenure as CEO of Alex & Ani, during which he helped grow the roughly $2 million jewelry business to a value well over $200 million. Recently, however, Ferosi has been named in a plethora of civil complaints related to the Benrus venture he took on following his time with Alex & Ani. With a swarm of media covering his personal finances, I wanted to dig into the elements of his campaign platform and who he believed he would be as a leader if he were to be elected governor of Rhode Island.
First of all, Bill, thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure.
Very cool space, by the way.
Thanks.
Probably be the coolest space I'll have an interview in.
Yeah.
So, you know, the high-level pitch, the reality is, I tout that I'm the most experienced person in the race. That's by design. I've worked my butt off, I guess is the right way to say it. But I'm an Italian immigrant who grew up in West Warwick, Rhode Island. Worked three jobs at a time my whole life. Went to the University of Rhode Island. Prior to starting URI, though, I joined the United States Army Reserve. Went on active duty basic training. Then in between my freshman and sophomore year, did advanced individual training, infantry. Then did ROTC my sophomore and junior year. And I was commissioned an officer. So I went in the Army, enlisted, then became an officer. Graduated from URI, political science degree. Ended up in small business with my brother, who became an optician. We were in the optical business, retail optical. Owned a business in North Kingstown called Ferocious Eyes Optical.
Sure.
Actually named it after the old Kim Carden song, Betty Davis Eyes.
Yeah.
She's ferocious.
That's awesome.
So that was off of our last name. Ended up being in the optical industry for a long time. Opened up a lot of stores and created services for a lot of college students primarily. Came up with College Optical Express. Always did the military simultaneously. And then most of us who served in the military in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s have what's called a pre-9/11 career and a post-9/11 career. So 9/11 went down, and I was in the Army. So for the next 5-plus years, just focused on the military. Ended up getting assigned to United States Central Command. I was a ground operations officer. Ended up working for General Tommy Franks. We were stateside at the time, MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. Ended up going to Qatar in 2002 and starting Camp Azalea from scratch. We built the command forward headquarters. 2004, I was part of the main effort for Operation Iraqi, excuse me, in 2002, 2003, we set up for Operation Iraqi Freedom. And then in 2003, I was part of the main effort of Operation Iraqi Freedom from March through May. In Qatar, where I worked in the Joint Operations Center, my team and I, we were part of tracking all of the conventional and special operations forces. Then 2004, I took the FBI to war, went up to Iraq with the FBI, we're conducting counterterrorism operations. And also, by that time, we had some civilians that were killed. And so we would always respond to that as well, and bombings and other things. 2005, I was put in charge of putting together the JIASIC, a joint interagency coordination group. We brought all elements of national power to war. So what that means is you bring all the core agencies. And once that was stood up, I became the first ever liaison to United States government from U.S. CENTCOM. So I coordinated all efforts between CENTCOM and the CIA, FBI, DEA, Department of Homeland Security, the Department of State, and the Department of the Treasury. Finished coming off active duty in 2006, went back into the optical world. I was also working on a software called Viopsis, Vision Operating System. Went back on active duty 2008 for one more year. I was asked to be the liaison from USARC, United States Army Reserve Command, to NORTHCOM, Army North. So we had stood up a new combatant command called Northern Command, take care of the homeland. Gave them my expertise for that year. And then 2009, met Carolyn Rafalian, who's the founder of Alex and Donnie. And we continued having conversations. And in 2010, I joined her. Went on to be the CEO of Alex and Donnie. Retired from the military that summer in 2010, after 24 years. And focused on being the CEO of Alex and Donnie. Was in charge of a company that went from $2 million in revenue to $238 million in basically 4 years. Went from 23 employees to 1,084 direct, created over 4,000 jobs in the Rhode Island economy. And more importantly, we were able to give tens of millions of dollars to charity, $12 million just in the time period I was there, and the programs are phenomenal. So with that, went on in 2014, left Alex and Donnie, and was focused on purchasing an old watch company called Benriss. Had a lot of great ideas for that, still do, but ended up in a trademark war for the better part of 3 years. Has not been fun, but you learn a lot of life's lessons. Another reminder that everything in life is temporary, so just kind of keep going. And when that turned into more of a legal matter, that's out of my hands, it's more of the courts type of thing, and let lawyers do that, it, you know, frankly put me in position to focus on the situation here as far as being governor of Rhode Island, so that I can put all of my life experience, more importantly, my vision for Rhode Island, into play, so that I can actually create a new economy for Rhode Island. And therefore, I jumped into the governor's race. But it'll be official May 20th. So thank you for giving me such a long few minutes to kind of go through that. But that's who I am. I would just add that in 2011, I went through the advanced management program at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And that, too, was another what I would call transitional moment in my life. Really had me understand what it's like to, what the difference is being a top tier CEO as opposed to something you just kind of put on a business card. So, that's where I am in life right now.
And it's interesting, you've, in your, you know, I guess you call it a trailer for The Fixer, the reality television show that you, I don't know if that ever went into production or not, but it sort of echoes, you know, to an extreme extent, but it sort of echoes a lot of what I heard in your soft announcement of, you know, you identify yourself as the person who has the managerial experience and knows how to mobilize departments, and you identified how you would run the state as sort of like a corporate org chart and with a governor at the top. And is that something that you feel like you've harnessed over? Do you have a specific way to enact that, or is it just a general sort of philosophy you have? Do you have any specific ways to translate that management skill?
Well, I think, you know, again, the CEO title often gets misrepresented or misinterpreted. You know, what you're there to do is set the strategic vision for the company and then put together the plan that will allow you to achieve that vision. And frankly, a leader is not necessarily required to be a great manager. You know, I'd like to think I am, but I'm more interested in, you know, the vision and holding the troops together to make sure we make it to the objective. You hire managers. So, you know, your chief operating officer, chief information officer, technical officer, all these other people. And all the directors and VPs and managers and all the way down the chain, everybody's, you know, contributing to meeting the objective. But it's moving that army. You know, I like to say lately, and I do use, you know, large examples. I'm on the George Washington kick, so to speak, because I believe that. You know, I believe they make individuals at certain periods of history. And I hope I'm that person. I hope I'm that person for Rhode Island. You know, it took George Washington to keep everyone together and to get through those harsh winters in Valley Forge and to keep on pushing. And then once you have achieved your initial objective, to maintain the goal that you really set out to do, which is to create a new nation and make sure it survives. So he certainly, I don't think anyone would suggest, is equal to, you know, the James Madisons of the world and the Ben Franklins and John Adams and Jefferson and all of that. But he was the leader, and he was the one who held it all together to fight the fight. And that's what I want to be. You know, that's what I want to be for Rhode Island. I will do that for you. And we will do it as a team. And, you know, when the tough, you know, things get tough and we all have to look at each other, I'm going to keep pushing you. And I'm going to remind you that it's okay because we're in battle. You know, we're here to fight a fight. You're going to get scars. I like to say people are going to get wounded. Some might get killed. That's part of the process, you know. And not physically, obviously, or literally in this case, but there is a process that you have to go through. And, you know, I celebrate my 50th birthday in a couple of weeks. And let me tell you, I'm 50 going on 100, you know, and I lived a heck of a life, a real life. And, you know, I think that's all good. You know, even to this day, I don't know why I have some of my experiences. God only knows, and, you know, I'm a believer, but they were given to me, and people are destined to do whatever they're supposed to be doing in life. That's my belief, you know.
Right, and it's interesting, over with Moira Walsh, Representative Moira Walsh, I remember there was a bit of a stir where you had basically said that she, given that her career as a was being a waitress, it didn't really qualify her to, you know, work with an enormous state budget. Is that kind of how you feel, that, you know, you would really want to make sure that people who are making decisions have the proper experience? Is that vetting,
training,
personnel training? Is that
training,
it?
Experience. You know, the reality is, if you were, you know, applying for a job at any major corporation, let alone one that has a $9.5 billion, you know, revenue stream, which is enormous. You know, a $1 billion company in valuation doesn't mean it's making $1 billion a year. It can be making $100 million and have a 10-time multiple. To actually have something that has $9.5 billion running through it, very few people are involved in something like that. And so you can, you know, imagine that people have gone to school their whole life, have worked decades to get to a certain point to maybe be part of that decision-making process. And here, what do we have? We have people who age and residency is the only requirement. That's wild. You know, I said this last night. I was up in Foster at a town county town committee meeting. I said, listen, you know, I honor our forefathers and I admire them. I don't defer to them, okay? We are at a different point in life. And this great experiment of ours, there's parts of it that didn't work. And if you're not honest enough to say that, you shouldn't be in charge. And so, you know, I looked at how I entered the state Senate. You know, I left that part out. I was the youngest senator in, you know, serving in the country when I was involved in 1992 through 95, 93, 94. Reality is, I looked and said, okay, why should I run? What are my qualifications? So, well, I have a degree in political science. I, you know, have worked my whole life. I know what it's like to work. I know what it's like to work time and a half, work on a Sunday and a holiday, and why I do that. I'm an Army officer. I was a first lieutenant. I was a business owner. So, well, why wouldn't I run? So, okay, just because I'm not 50. Well, that's not a good reason. So I'm ready to go, and I'm going to go. And I ran, and I think I served quite well, and I was part of some really big decisions. You know, we reduced the size of the General Assembly. We put term limits on general officers. We built the Providence Place Mall. We built the airport, you know. All these things that were done, who was the leader? Bruce Sundlin. Look up. I ask everybody, look up who Bruce Sundlin was.
I had him as a professor, you know? Actually, URI.
Well, look at his Wikipedia. Look at his background. Here's a guy, you know, who out of his crew, maybe 14-member crew or whatever was members of his crew, I believe 5 were killed and, you know, X amount were taken captives. He was the only one to make it out, you know, and get out. And then when he was free, He went back and cross enemy lines. I mean, this is crazy stuff. But you know what? It makes sense. Because they made guys like George Washington. They made guys like Bruce Sumner. And you know what? They make guys like me. And am I, you know, obviously, you know, going to be judged someday by others, obviously, and we'll see where things fall. But your contribution can only be dictated by what you offer and by the circumstances of the times. And so right now, you know, I'm ready to rock and roll. We're ready to change Rhode Island. And I told these people last night, I said, I'm here to change your life. I'm not kidding. So, you know, we can complain about all this other stuff, but are you ready to go? If you're ready to go, then you get behind me and let's go. You know, it's not going to be, we're not going to be all nice and we're not going to, you know, this. We're here to make massive change. And we're very fortunate because we can do it in a smaller environment we're in. But it takes courage and it takes somebody who doesn't care about themselves more than they care about Rhode Island.
Is that something you're concerned about with the current administration? That,
yes.
That perception that maybe she's seeking higher office and a national level and this is a stepping stone. Is that something that you
absolutely believe and in? I don't think she's alone. I think that, you know, when you hear and look at people and why they run, and you say to yourself, you know, why do you run? Like, listen to their own words. Well, you know, I have to see maybe if it's good for me or, you know, if it's the right time for me. Me, that's what they keep saying. If it's the right time for my family, your family, not mine, you know. And instead, the way it should work is, who cares about me? And frankly, who cares about my family? Other than that they're citizens of Rhode Island, so you should care about them in that regard. It's not about me and my family. It's about Rhode Islanders. It's about Rhode Island. So this is something I believe, and this is what drives me. I've already lived my life. I want you to know that. I've lived it. You know, you brought up the fixer and the fact that I hope someday it goes in production. It should. The reality is, I've lived a life at every point that I was supposed to live that life. If I'm in college, I lived a college life. If I'm in the Army, I lived an Army life. If I was, you know, in business, I'm living a business life. If I'm in politics, I'm living a political life. And we keep trying to, like, mix and match all everybody's life. Oh, look, when they were 19, who cares? That was when they were 19. That's when they were 19, they were doing what 19-year-olds do. It's just we keep, you know, disqualifying people. And I look at why, and what I've come to the conclusion is that there's a very small elite class that have never done the hard work and been through the rigors that I would say the majority of us have been through. There's no perfect life. And therefore, they know they would be disqualified if experience was the way we voted. And so if we're voting on experience, they'd all be disqualified. So they're sitting there going, oh, wait a minute, try and get rid of this guy, and try and get rid of her, and let's try and get rid of, because we want to just run, and we're perfect. Because look, you know, I'm valedictorian, or I'm this, I'm that. It's like, you know, I hire valedictorians, relax. You know, I don't, that's, you know, I'm glad you are, and you did well in school. But, you know, maybe the rest of us also had 3 paper routes, and we're trying to roof houses, and we're cleaning rugs with a rug doctor that weighed more than us. You know, just to try and put gas in the car. And you try and make that class and try and get an A, you know? So that's life.
Right. What about those who would say that the experience outside of areas that directly relate to governance, you know, maybe running a small business, who knows what, dealing with children, working in medicine, whatever it may be. Don't those jobs have experiences that would qualify someone to have leadership roles in state government, or is it only those who have a finance and legal background that you see as qualified?
No, not at all. I mean, if we look at, you know, why we have the legislature set up as we have it, it is meant to have a varied background of, you know, fabric of the community making decisions. What I'm saying is that doesn't mean you don't also get the other qualifications. You know, I can't just make you a judge. Like, you need to be a lawyer. You know, you have to have a law degree. I can't just make you whatever. You know, I'm going to be general tomorrow. That's not the way it works. You know, I have to go through my officer's basic course. I have to go through my advanced course. I have to go to command staff in general. I got to go through things. And so what I would suggest is we, you know, set aside monies, which we spend so much of. Take the monies and use it right. Take some money, set it aside, have some leadership courses and some, you know, really certifications and some real, you know, academia that relates to your job in that role. Get these people certified and then keep going. You know, so you get elected, but now the first 3-6 months, you need to get all your training. You know, when I took the job at as being liaison from USARC to Army North, I had to get what was called DISCA certified. It's defense support for civil authorities. So I had to understand what FEMA does. I had to understand there's 10 regions. I had to understand what an EPLO, Emergency Preparedness Liaison Officer, is. You know, he lives in Maine but takes care of Puerto Rico if something goes down. Like, I have to understand it all. How do I run it? How do you make any decision? You don't even know how it works.
You feel like there's a breakdown of 360-degree communication and understanding in state government right now? Is that something that's
There's just a you know, I'll tie it back to where I was going to go, and I never finished my thought on would these people get hired for the position that they would, you know, they wouldn't even be interviewed, let alone hired. That's just a fact. Now, that said, many have years of experience on the job, right? So that's like any other job. You get good at it by being in the job, right? I'm not going to sit here and discount a lot of experience they have. What I'm saying, though, is it will benefit the state of Rhode Island if we actually create programs, and not just the state of Rhode Island, it'll be universal, really, at the federal level on down, to make sure people also understand revenue, expenses, how to, you know, what the second or third order effect are of your decision making. You can't just run around and say, yeah, you know, free sick days or free this. Like, just calm down. You know, obviously people want sick days. But what's the second and third order effect if you do the following? You know, one of the things that happened to me at Benrus was a direct attack by the administration, by the Department of Labor and Training, you know, not understanding that when we were pre-revenue, we decided to make everyone a partner. When you make everyone a shareholder, a partner, that means they all get K-1s. They can't get a W-2. So why are you asking me to have workers' comp insurance? It doesn't even make sense. But because literally the people in it don't understand it, what they're doing is causing newspaper stories. They're causing detrimental activity. And you're sitting there going, well, what do I do? Well, you know, all right, I'll stroke this check just to get them away from me. But I literally just gave people money that they don't deserve. Because the professionals already knew, no, you're going to be pre-revenue. How many people do we have? Do we want to make them shareholders? We'll vest them immediately. They'll all get K-1s. We don't have W-2s. Rhode Island Law 29-2-1 means you can do the following. Da-da-da-da. Okay. But because we're not Delaware, because we're not New York, because we're not Boston, you know, the lack of information, the lack of a peer group, both in actual corporate entities and for myself as a, you know, executive, they're not dealing with it. So they don't even know what it is. And I'm sitting there going, do I risk the fact that they might actually give me a penalty here for $150,000 or do I stroke a check for $12,000? You know, because no one even understands it. Very scary stuff, you know. But
how deep does this go, in your opinion, throughout Rhode Island government? I mean, there's always legacy issues like the Department of Transportation. You see cones set up where there's no work being done for months at a time and all things of this sort. Is that part of what, you know, that communication breakdown, is that something that is statewide, or you really see it in more of the fiscal management of the state?
No, I think that across the board, I mean, you're seeing it primarily. I mean, one of the biggest disasters that we've ever faced, probably in history of the state, is this UHIP disaster. When you have political appointees instead of, you know, degreed professional appointments that are leading areas of business that require that. I'll give you an example, even just in regular business, right? I advise a number of companies, and one of them, she's been extremely successful. Started a company, did $2.5 million, and did $5 million. And she did $2.2 million, you know, in a quarter. And I'm like, oh my God, you know what? We're going to set up a plan. We're going to have a CFO come in at this time. Oh no, I don't want a CFO. I don't want this. Well, what do you mean? well, you know, I've done this all myself. Yeah, well, that was good for this period of time. Now that you're going to track and you're going to bring this to a $100 million company, no bank, nobody's going to want to do business with you unless you can verify the financials, unless there's certified professionals that are involved in the decision-making process. You know, why do you think I went to Wharton in 2011? I want to make sure that people look and say, okay, this is a real CEO. It's not just someone who's self-anointed, you know, and appointed. So, you know, in that regard, to answer your question, you know, it's across the board from the management side. As far as the rest of it, though, that's efficiency, that's work ethic. You know, the beauty of my history of the last 8 years or so was that I recognized everything in life is about systems and standards. It's really two words. And so I was fortunate because at Alex and Donnie, we had a lot of first-time employees. They graduated college, came on in. So they didn't know any other way. They just thought, okay, Mr. Ferrosi said this is the way we do it, and this is the way we do it. And they're building stores with four people while Taco Bell's takes 17. So, you know, and then the guy from Taco Bell's asking me for a job, but it's tough for me to bring him in because he's used to running 17 people. And I'm used to doing it with four. And so, you know, it's just different.
Let's kind of turn there briefly, just jobs in general and how that translates. In your opinion, is the lack of affordable housing or the lack of jobs contributing more to what we see, everything from homelessness to just what seems like a lower standard of living for many Rhode Islanders? Or is it something altogether different than that?
So again, very important questions, but I will directly connect it to leadership again in the first regard. I mean, you brought up Representative Walsh. Not only is she not a waitress anymore, she's vowed to, she doesn't work. She's made the fact she's a representative her job. That's not a full-time job. You're making it that, and you're saying, okay, I'm going to live off X amount.
$15,000.
Whatever. Yeah, and then what happens? Now you have someone running for lieutenant governor who did the same thing.
Representative Regenberg.
Yes. And now they're saying, okay, let's all run for office. Let's all do this. So not only don't they want a standard that we all not only should look at differently and should want to achieve someday, they're creating a standard. They're trying to lower the standard of who we are as a people.
In what sense? In the sense that you can survive off of?
Why do we just want to survive? Why don't we want to thrive? It's weird. It's just a whole weird world. So, you know, no one wants that. You know, you make 15, okay, circumstances bring you into situations. No one's doubting that. You know, I can sit there and let me tell you something. I'll give more Walsh, anybody else, more war stories than they can ever give me. All right? I've sat there with my dad reading him while he's stories while he's learning Braille and, you know, having big boxes of cheese that we got through WIC and everything else. But you know what? My parents wanted to hurry up and get off of that. They were embarrassed. You know, we didn't want to pay for food with food stamps. Now they give people a gold card. Okay? So it's just a different way of thinking. And I will fight that fight, regardless of how uncomfortable they think I might get in a war of words. I won't get uncomfortable. I've lived that life. I never want that life ever again. And I want to, you know, those that have been part of extreme poverty know the difference. And they all support me. You'd be shocked at who supports me. I'd love to have you meet some of these people that went on. And, you know, I said, listen, I grew up in a house with mother with mental illness and an abusive father or a father who passed away or left the home or whatever it is. And, you know, had my siblings, I had to, you know, be in charge of them as well. And, you know, and finally someday I moved away and this is what I made with my life. And I now run a sales staff of 55 people. In the largest operation in the U.S. or the world, and this is what I do, and I never want to see that again. The woman I mentioned earlier, her business, she grew up in an orphanage, you know, never wants to see that again. Trust me, it is not normal. And so, you know, to your point, or to my point in response to your question, it is that way because they've lowered standards. So remember, everything's systems and standards.
They being the General Assembly or?
No, they met some components of the General Assembly who, in fact, want to turn the society into one that relies more on government than it does on their own work ethic and their own expectations of having a higher income.
What about those who just can't obtain that income, though, who are working, doing everything they can, but because maybe of the nature of their field or sure. because of taking, you know, you identify yourself as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. which I do agree with your assessment of entrepreneurship versus small business, that there is a difference, and it has to do with maybe taking a personal bath. You know, I know that from experience.
Risk.
I'm all in here. You know what I mean?
Risk.
We're all in here. It is risk, and it's tight. But, you know, I have personally survived off of less than $15,000 a year. In fact, my wife and I both have survived off of that.
That's right.
For many years. And I don't see how that would affect my ability to make a decision about a bill before me or anything like that.
So
or influence. I'm not advocating. Every day we want you want to grow. But of course, the notion is you want to get out of it. I'm not saying that that's a comfortable place to be in. It isn't.
Sure.
But how do you nurture a person while at the same time, you know what I mean, trying to get them to step away from, we have now 30% of the population of Rhode Island on some form of public assistance. So it's a difficult backpedal.
Yeah, you have to make it unacceptable.
And you think that's a cultural type of movement?
Absolutely cultural. It starts with cultural. You know, like I said, I've never had less than three jobs.
Yep.
You know, this is what I'm trying to say. You know, not only did I have it harder, you know, we're immigrants. We came here, you know, my parents didn't speak English. But you know what? They went to night school to learn English. You know, part of what we're doing here, and I say it all the time, I'm going to have huge opportunities in different communities because people are going to say, wait a minute, okay, he's a Republican businessman who's running for governor. He's not going to come over here. You are so wrong. I'm going to go over there at first, and I'm going to show you what you can do. And guess what? People who are trying to make decisions for other people have it wrong. I'm going to let them make their own decisions. I'm going to tell them my story. And they're going to appreciate it, and they're going to say, wow, I can be that guy. And just like my dad, he went to night school. You know, we became citizens the minute we could become citizens. We all became citizens. You know, you don't leave El Salvador to bring El Salvador here. we didn't leave Italy
in the poverty we had in Italy
and the lack of jobs. They didn't come here to replicate that. Mm-hmm. They came here to be the United States. And so we have this very wrong-headed approach to how we manage culture. You know, we all love culture. You know, I love going to certain restaurants. I love meeting certain people. I love going to certain churches. I love going to certain environments where you can really take a deep dive in a culture. But that doesn't mean that the base of it isn't a common communication that allows us all to thrive. So my cousin Margaret can tell you, okay, I've worked the same place for 28 years, and she's like, because I learned English, I was able to become the manager, even though she just came in 1978 or 84 or whatever it was. Because she knew that. She still has her accent. She still has her, but you know what? She thrived. And so, but, you know, ultimately it's about understanding you don't have to make decisions based on what you have. You can actually determine what you want, and then you have to figure out, how do I get it? You know, so maybe you have to work three jobs, maybe you work two. Maybe you don't want it. I'm at a point in my life where I told you, I already lived once. Someone's like, oh, do you miss your mansion in Newport? Listen, I can have all the money in the world. I just don't want something that big to take care of anymore. I'll buy a boat. Like, I want something with flexibility, you know, or I'll get a cool condo that does XYZ. It could be the same price, but just maybe I want something different. So everybody's at a different stage. It's not about who's better or you're right or who's successful. I don't want to be misinterpreted or misconstrued about that. What I'm saying is, aside from those that require assistance, meaning, you know, physical limitations or mental limitations or other things that we need to support, those that are able-bodied and ready to roll, there are over 3 million jobs in the U.S. posted right now. You cannot tell me you can't get a job. And I'm okay if you don't want one. And I'm just saying you in general, right? But, for example, if I went to Newport Creamery, which I did, and I can't go to Newport Creamery where it doesn't say apply within. Just say you don't want to work at Newport Creamery.
What about the standard? Do you feel like the minimum wage is too low? I mean, or a lot of these jobs, you got to take the second job, but maybe the second job requires a qualification a person doesn't have. How do you, now you've got an educational issue. How does that all get bridged together? Where does it start?
Well, I do think on the education side, we have enormous opportunity. Part of my Rhode Island Business Act would be to, you know, provide tuition reimbursements to companies. More importantly, I think that education needs to be changed completely. You know, going to school, just hanging out, taking classes, paying all this money for what? New buildings? You know, everybody stop. Understand what we're really doing, you know, and let me get into a situation where we have enormous industry coming in, people going and working for the company right away. Let the company pay to get them trained, educated, continuing education credits, other things that are required, any type of professional development. Let's fund and help that. And but you have to look at things in a strategic way. And that's the other part, right? So I could have, and I was, in business for decades. And then I understood what it's like to work at a strategic combatant command. I understood what it's like to grow a business that has thousands of employees. I know what it's like to be at the highest floor of the biggest financial institutions in the world, you know, and literally have the heads of the banks, the ones you read about every day, asking me if, you know, their Italian cufflinks will fit in their Australian shirt, or if, you know, what do I think about this, or have them text me, or spending an hour and a half in their office, an hour and a half in mine, all in the same month. But you know what? I say a statement like that, or I got interviewed recently on a radio show, and I mentioned two big names like Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan or Brian Moynihan. Do you know the next day, like on Twitter, et cetera, I saw a state rep make fun of me. Like he had a meme where he's the guy spit out coffee. Like, who do you think Ferocci thinks he is talking about them? What do you mean? That's the world I live in. You know, stop making fun of Rhode Islanders. Stop believing that there aren't Rhode Islanders who play Division I ball, who are at the top tier in their field. You know, will we always get it right? No. Will things be tough sometimes? Yes. But that's why you get hired. You know, that's why you get hired. And, you know, but it ultimately comes down to believing in everyone can achieve something. So it's not that I don't appreciate the Representative Walshes of the world. I really do actually, believe it or not, admire them. I'm just saying you need to take time to go check the other boxes. It can only help, okay? So please get that training. Please get that. And you'll understand a little bit more that there's only so much time in a day. There's only so much time in a session, in a year. And we can't front load it just worrying about this. I say this all the time. For example, I have five kids. So listen, I love my kids. I want to take care of everything, right? But let's not forget the elderly. We keep talking about the children, the children, the children, the children. People are forgetting about the elderly. And everyone's living longer, right? So where's the, you know, time out for a minute? Okay, the kids all set? Okay. You can relax. You can maybe tonight you take off from going to this or that. Relax. We got to take care of Nana, or we got to take care of somebody else today that needs attention. And that's all I'm saying is there's a kind of a disproportionate amount of attention. And I believe that's a result of not understanding the complexity of life and really how the world works. If I may just add one other thing. Sort of like when you hear about, you know, the 1% and the corporations this and the corporations that and Wall Street and this and that. Well, what do you think Wall Street's made up of? Who owns the biggest companies in the world? They're called pension funds. And who are the pension funds? They're the teachers. They're the unions. So it's like you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. You know? You don't like the return you got on your fund. Yet you want to kick, you know, the guys who are running it's butt out the door because they're, you know, losing their hair and figuring out how to, you know, manage this monster and get you a result that you want. But at the same time, you get to kick them for free when you're actually, you own it. You own part of the biggest companies in the world. So it's really just a weird, and I bet you if you were to go and take a you know, a poll or just ask some basic questions, I would bet anything that a high percentage wouldn't even know what I just said.
Right, but a high percentage of teachers wouldn't understand that their pension
not even the teachers. I'm talking the decision makers.
The decision makers, all the way up to. All the way up the chain to the governor.
You know, she knows because she's making money off of it. You know, she's part of Point Judith Capital. You know, the state of Rhode Island invested $5 million into her pension fund. I mean, this is how crazy this whole thing is. But, you know, we stay focused, positive message, create a new environment. More importantly, you know, I'm all over blockchain, which right. I've been talking about lately. It's about creating industry. So if jewelry was the industry, all the way up and through 1979, we used to be the jewelry capital of not only America, the world. 75% of the world's costume jewelry used to be made in Rhode Island. It's amazing, amazing. You know, and going back to textiles before that and just everything, you know, and since that we have, you know, obviously water-based, you know, achievements that are you know, anywhere from seafood to, you know, how we support General Dynamics and other things. But the reality is we now have an opportunity with blockchain technology to create the infrastructure legislatively to become the hub of not only the United States but the world, to say this is where all of the companies involved in blockchain have come to have implanted a foot in the ground and a flag in the ground to say, this is home. It could be on paper as a corporation. It could be a physical building that supports larger efforts.
Superman building, potentially.
Yeah, a lot of different things. But more importantly, but educationally, we can have our institutions literally, you know, putting out the coders of tomorrow that need to make all the technology. They're self-taught right now. There's no one it's an unregulated industry. There are people that literally have to go on open source and teach themselves. There's no certification. There's no degrees. We can create all that. And just think then the jobs that come off of that. Anywhere from the administrative assistant to the professors that are teaching it to the people who are going to build the companies and they're going to transition everything to blockchain.
And
that are now our internet.
That's predicated on the idea that inevitably there will be some regulation and institutionalization of this.
There will.
And why not get in the lead and
make this the kind of default best place to incorporate in, the best place to put your company, the best place to retire after you made your millions. You know, this is where you want to be. And conduct transactions. You know, you can have operations maybe somewhere else. You can have your headquarters here. You know, when I was younger, I remember went into Hartford when it was the insurance capital of America, you know, and you're driving up, and all of a sudden you knew you were in Hartford. You saw all the different buildings, all the insurance companies. And that's what I'm saying, is just to be able to see that skyline and say, wow, okay, we're here. You know, Silicon Valley owned it for the internet. So did Seattle and a few other places. But now the blockchain's coming. And the first two states to make a move right now are Wyoming and North Carolina. We need to move fast. And if we do it, you can't beat us. Our location, our proximity between Boston and New York, second to none. Housing, you know, which I wanted to really answer your question, I'm sorry, was on the housing part. The second component was to understand that, yes, people are ending up in certain situations because of economic conditions, but we also need to create different types of housing. It's just reality. You know, I look at tiny houses and all these shows, and I'm like, yeah, when I was a kid, they were called mobile homes. Yeah. But the reality is you can make them cool, right? You can make something really, really, really cool. And so I say to people, I'm like, you know what? My kids, they want a house that looks like my iPhone, you know? They don't want to live in the old, big, whatever. They want something cool. Maybe I'll take it with me. I'll plug it in. I want to be in Providence today? Yeah, I'm going to rent it for the month. I'm going to live in Providence. Just plug it in. You know, maybe I want to move to Narragansett next month. Okay, I'm going to go to Narragansett next month. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And we need to understand that's reality. You know, prefab houses. Maybe Quonset should be filled with factories that just make components of housing. They just slap them together and build them on site. Imagine no more construction. Imagine not having a street that you have to put up with that's putting a house in. Imagine the house just shows up. You just plug it in. And the whole thing was made in Quonset. That's what's going to happen. That's reality. I live in reality, and that's the difference. But I also live, more importantly, as someone who's always in the forefront of vision. You know, I've had the first two Teslas, one of the first two Teslas in Rhode Island, you know, when I bought, when they first came out. And everyone's like, oh, you know, it's going to work. And you never drove it. And, well, how do you, what do you mean you bought two cars? You didn't even test drive it. I said, listen, if they work, I'll have one of the first ones. If they don't work, I'll have one of the only ones. I said, so either way, I'm good. But, right. Now,
of course,
you know,
the lanes are a rocket, upright, you know.
It's crazy. What these visionaries do is absolutely insanity.
So you're trying to inspire visionary activity. That's where you're coming from on this. And you're just trying to put the pieces in place for, you know, as you say, the center point, the leader of a large, small, whatever size organization that can go to any person in Rhode Island, immigrant, non-citizen, illegal immigrant. Does that include? Would that person have that same opportunity to?
What was the last one?
An illegal immigrant, someone who is.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that there's, you know, we've taken a step to break that down with the dreamers and then, you know, the balance. You know, I am somebody who looks at dreamers differently. I do think that, you know, we need to satisfy that area and make them citizens and get to the, you know, a path that gets them there. And in the interim, you just got to make it all work, you know. And but illegal immigrants, I absolutely want the distinction. I'm a legal immigrant. There's a distinction. We can't just have, you know, lawless societies. We need to understand what they are. But again, it goes back to the actual culture and societies and in places they live to make that distinction. They say it's not going to fly. But, you know, I'm not going to go and take a 16-year-old who's lived here for the last 15 years and does, who was, you know, born here, et cetera, and make them go move to a country they never been to. It's insane. So, you know, it takes logic most of the time to begin conversations. But, you know, following the law and when it comes to immigration, all nations go through it. You know, I think that's the one part that I take offense to when, you know, Rhode Islanders and Americans try and have a conversation and everyone makes it about an emotional issue. And, you know, it's like, no, go to Italy right now and try and have a conversation there. And they'll tell you about all the problems they're having with such and such nation or such and such nation and the invasion of this or tent cities or garbage that's piling up in the streets or, again, lawless activity. You know, that's one nation, but it's all over the world. You know, everyone wants to, you know, protect their nation, their borders, and we should be allotted that opportunity. But we have a discussion to be had. Let's knock out the dreamer side and then get rocking and rolling. You know, but the HB1 visas, all these things, they're important. You know, and that's really the sad part of these conversations. Is listen, no, I do want brain power. I want smart people. I want them working here from other nations that can come and work in companies that we need their professional expertise in. But it's going to be part of a process. But we should, you know, make it so it's quick and fast and make it all work. And, you know, and I think it'll happen. But remember, it's a different way of thinking. We have to move forward. You know, I look at other candidates. I say to everybody all the time, my positive message, my vision, it's all about, okay, get behind somebody, all right? Everybody, you're going to get behind somebody right now, and we're going to go. Who are you going to get behind? And my suggestion is if you get behind anybody else but me, you're not going anywhere. But it's just a fact. It's an absolute fact. And there's a lot of good people, and they're friends of mine, and I like them, but they're not me. And I will go bust down that door. We're going to move on. We're going to become the best state in the nation. I know the conversation levels I need to have. I know the professionals I need to bring in. And I know how to get this thing done. And sometimes the professionals reside right here. And you have to understand, you know, why it's important to make sure that we take care of Rhode Island in a way that doesn't disrupt the culture. And for me, the culture is work ethic. Rhode Island was built a certain way. And that's been the real disruption, is we've just kind of let go of who we are as a people. And then we need to get back, you know, get back to that. And it's here. We're ready to run.
That's really the message of your campaign, is we got to get back to work. We've been kind of playing it safe for
a while here. Maintenance mode. I call it the maintenance mode. They've been in maintenance, men. They just, you know, keep it the way it is. You know, put some tape on it. I'm just, my life changed. I've seen the other side, you know. I am not satisfied with, you know, something that's not perfect if it's supposed to be perfect, you know. I'm not, like, I want it a certain way, you know. And again, it goes back, though, really to how I was brought up. You know, we didn't have any money. I used to eat literally Italian bread day old that we would just break it up and put it in milk, put some sugar on it. That was what we ate, you know. And sometimes we had pain de gâteau, just boiled it in water, and that's what we ate. And these aren't, you know, I always kind of get, you know, I hate war stories all the time. Oh, woe is me and this and that, you know. But I'm just bringing it up, saying, I've been there, done that. I don't like that. I'd rather have filet. You know, I'd rather have something different. And don't tell all these people who live here that they can't have it. They can have it. If they want it, I'm going to create the opportunities. And if you don't want it, that's cool. That's fine. Just say you don't want it. That's okay. We're all different. Like I said, you know, my life, I've lived once. What I really want to do next is, you know, my governorship, I want to write. I want to teach. You know, I'm not out to be ambitious. I'm not out to be, you know, get the biggest yacht in the world and go golf in Palm Beach and do all this other stuff. Do I like it? Do I like beaches? Do I like? Sure. I'll go on somebody else's yacht, you know, and I'll do somebody else. I'll go there once or twice and call it a day, you know, wait for grandkids, relax. But I like to teach. I like to write. I want to do other things. And, you know, going back to the ambition of politicians, they're already looking at their next job. And that's the biggest problem we have, is we've had career politicians. They've never been part of real decision making, high level decision making.
Do you find Mayor Fung's situation, where he ran for mayor and kind of began his gubernatorial campaign shortly thereafter, not officially, but sort of unofficially, do you find that part of the systemic problem? And what about Joe Trillo, and where he says, I'm not necessarily asking you to compare platforms, but just as far as their experience, do you feel like they've been too far into the machine?
Well, like I said, I'm really focused on my own positive message and vision. And I just say, you know, compare resumes. That's it. Just look at resumes. You know, people want to talk about, you know, good, bad things, good things, whatever. I just say, look at it all. Just, is there a difference? You know, there's a difference when I was a private in the Army. There's a difference when I, you know, 25 years later. There's just a difference. And so, you know, there's the same way if Joe, you know, spent a lot of time in the legislature, he's going to have way more experience than I did in the legislature, right? In that area. Same thing with Alan. He's a mayor. He's a great mayor. I like him. I like him as mayor. It doesn't mean that what needs to be done for Rhode Island in the future can be done better by someone other than me with what I'm trying to do. You know, can they learn from me? Sure. I hope they learn from me. I hope they see how I did it. I hope they go and get training, and then they get, you know, build out their network to understand. But this happens universally. You understand? There's 50 states. Trust me, I've met more than I can't even remember how many governors I've met in my lifetime. Okay? So many. And so many probably shouldn't have been governor. You know, and we have to remember that. It's not somebody's turn. It's not somebody's, you know, just, oh, I have nothing else to do, so I'm going to run. I mean, these are the comments people make. It's wild. It's absolutely wild. You know, there's a certain group that vote, you know, want me to lose. And I can tell you who it's led by. People who want me to be the CEO of their company. That's just a fact. It's so funny because I, you know, they're like, really? Do you have to do this right now? Just run the company. Just do this. I'm like, no, listen, I'm going to help Rhode Island. I'm going to run this thing and do it right. They're going to see the difference. It'll never go backwards once they've seen the difference. You know, people like power windows in their car.
Right.
You know, it's not, they're going to see the difference. Be like, yeah, I don't really want to reach over and crank that window down anymore, you know, because that's the life we've been living. And unfortunately, people told us that's a standard, and it's not. It's wrong. We'll fix it. We'll move on. A fixer, Rhode Island.
A fixer, yeah. I just want to ask you, this controversy is a little stale now. It's about a week old, this whole Starbucks scenario. But I got to ask you about Joe Trillo's comments. Where do you sit in this race? Do you support that sort of sentiment of, you know, Mr. Trillo didn't specifically say this, but you can assert that he has, you know, maybe not the experience required to understand the plight of a black person. Does that seem right to you, that he seems out of touch with his remarks, you know, which were basically that anytime he basically said on Twitter that anytime a person of color breaks the law, that individual is now, you know, protected by those who would say any prosecution of them is racist. You know, is that?
No, you know, I looked at obviously what he said, and I heard what he said, and kind of had two reactions to it. And I can't, you know, forget the fact that I'm running for governor, right? So, in the fact that he said it, I think it benefits my race in running for governor. I don't mean to make light of it, you know?
Right.
Those are his words, and that's his thoughts, and there are those that might believe that. And some might also, you know, it's like any issue. They'll see the aspects they agree with it on and then just kind of perpetuate those and not look at the full, you know, scope of you know, what's happening. As far as the balance of your statement, you know, let's face it. There are struggles that go on in the minority community that are, you know, happening daily, hourly, by the minute. Statistics always kick in. But I think in this case, you know, one can just look at it in isolation. And when you look at it and you look at the video, obviously there's an issue there. I mean, it's common sense, you know, that I just don't understand where it came from on the political side, like why you would do a press release and those things. But, you know, again, for me, I'm glad that, you know, I'm in the Republican primary. I'm glad a Republican didn't say it and just move on, you know.
Right. Of course, Joe Trillo is now an independent. So it is, how many opponents do you have in this primary? What is it?
You know, I think at this point it's somewhere like nine or in the primary.
Sorry.
So there are two, Mayor Alan Fung and Minority Leader Patricia Morgan.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, of course, right.
Yes.
All right, and you feel good about going into that primary? Like your message is the one that's going to drive the Republican Party forward? Is that how you're?
Well, it's twofold. I mean, it's the message certainly, which is why I hope people vote for me, and the experience on a personal level and the fortitude and you know, leadership that I have. But the second component is there's a path to victory, and that's a mathematical path. And I know my get-out-the-vote effort will make me the primary winner. And that's just going to be a fact. It doesn't matter what everybody else does. We have a ground game. We know how to do it. We know who to get. We know them by name. We know why they're voting for me. We know what inspires them. And we will make sure that they show up at the polls. And I don't want to win, you know, just by the hair or whatever. And I want to blow by it. I want to win with 60 points. I want to win that in the primary. I want to win in the general. I want 60 points. You know, there are people who get in the race who are doing the math going, oh, I can win with
23.7%.
It's nuts. It's just goofy.
Know, right.
Why would you even want to be the leader of something where 75% of the people don't want you?
Right, so close just, call in the last election, just a few percentage
points. Well, we need to
separated.
Fix it. We need to fix it. Yeah. You know, it goes back to who has the courage to fix things. You know, we need a runoff. And there's people who will, you know, rant up and down. Oh, no. They'll find every which way to say no. Let me say this. If you want to succeed in life, it's your job to find out how to say yes. That's your job. Okay? I could pay any lawyer $50 an hour to get a no. Okay? If I'm paying you $250 or $500, you better figure out how to make it a yes and work it out, you know? And that's the hard work, but very few people want to, you know, do the work. But that's okay. That's why you have, you know, people who lead and others that follow and everybody in between. And, you know, it's all about opportunity. The United States is about opportunity. You know, just the process itself, I feel great because when I win in September, I will be the candidate of a major political party and all that comes along with it. And the beauty is I would have beaten the previous nominee and I would have beaten the, you know, House Minority Leader and therefore have the full wind at my back. And since we have such a late primary, we have 8 weeks to spend a couple of $1 million. You can't even do it, really. I mean, you'll be saturated. So you want to grab that momentum. You want to go. And I feel confident every single day. I mean, I feel more confident. But you have to be careful, you know. You don't want to get overconfident. You just want to focus. But I feel it. I mean, I know it. I know I've had this feeling before. You just, you know, when you're doing something right, you just see kind of everything's falling into place for you. And so, you know, I think that, you know, some of the real hardship that I've had in my life, even in recent years, is really a great preparation for, you know, what is your job to assess as important and where the victories are. So that, you know, I'm not, you know, going into it thinking, oh, yeah, this is great, and this is great, and this is great, and this is great. No, it's like, no, I understood what she just said and why that's important, the way she said it. I understand why, you know, I don't know this guy, and he just wrote me. And I understand why this person wants to work on the campaign, and I would have thought they'd be with somebody else, et cetera. So all of those things coming together, and it's all about timing in life. And, you know, I was elected to the state Senate as a Republican. I beat an incumbent back in 92. The same year, Bill Clinton, who's a Democrat, got elected president. So when people want change, they're ready to go. And I think the polls have shown people want change. And that's on both sides. You know, they just want someone brand new. And I'm ready to rock and roll. And we're going. And who would have thought that somebody brand new had all this experience? In other words, already served in the Senate 25 years ago, was a combat veteran, was a small business owner, built a billion-dollar company, has 5 kids, been married, been divorced, had lost their dad. But all the things in life that I've been through, and you get that person to be the new face. That's pretty wild. And so I'm excited about it. I'll just work hard. You know, you got to keep going. And don't prejudge people. You'll be shocked how many people who have less than the 15,000 we talked about, you know, who've lived like you and I on 6,000 or 3,000 or whatever it took. I've lived those years, trust me. who actually think conservatively, who actually would default and say, I don't want to live like this. I know I can get there, and thank you. I have one gentleman who's working on my campaign. Man, if you heard his life story, it'd blow your mind. And he pulled me over about 3 years ago, maybe now. He said, you don't know me, and I know you think I'm crazy. I just pulled you over here, but we'll be working together someday. And I looked up and I laughed, and sure enough, he was persistent, and he's a wonderful man, and he's somebody who will deliver for me thousands of votes because of his capability in networking and his ability to understand that in order for him to change his life, he needed to get away from the people who were holding him down and move instead onto people that were going to make him a better person. And really, that is apropos in politics. That's really what I'm asking you to do. Stop hanging out with the people who are going to hold you down and come with me instead. You know?
Your message is definitely distinct in this race, and it definitely stands out from everyone else I've talked to or as I've followed along. You know, it's really power to the individual. And I'm not sure, you know, I don't know if I haven't actually read your platform in detail, but the specific ways you'd execute this, you know, big plan, you know, it's a large plan of culturally changing Rhode Island.
It's going to take
decades.
Well, it will. But you need to start it. And that's what I'm trying to tell people. And I said it when I gave my Rhode Island Papers delivery, the speech back on April 10th. You know, it's a little awkward to talk about your own demise in life, right? But I said, these papers will outlive me. That's true. What I wrote is the blueprint for Rhode Island's future. And not just some fancy words that, you know, you do when you run a campaign and you say, okay, click on this for my platform. I wrote the Rhode Island Papers. It will change Rhode Island forever. They need to get to work. They need to implement them. You know, do big things. Do big things. Don't just say it. You have to do it. But you have to commit to an overall strategy. It goes back to backwards planning. If you determine, like, what you really want, your purpose in life is something that you and others can determine for you. And I say others, too, because when I went through the Warren School of Business Advanced Management Program, my team, there were 60 of us, right? And there were 14 Americans. The rest were from around the world. And we were broken down into teams of 10. And my team, you know, on the last day before we left, you had to leave the room. And people would write down your purpose in life. They'd come to a consensus and write it down on a piece of paper for you and then hand it to you before you left. And I look back, and it ended up being exactly what I do and what I told you I want to do in the future as well, which is write and speak a very positive message to the rest of the world. And that made sense because, you know, as we gelled as a group, weeks later, months later, people would be like, oh, this guy's saying something. They'd all look at me because they know I'm going to hit my button and say something pretty dramatic. While other cultures might not, you know, even mention something, they would just kind of sit there and take whatever delivery was given by whatever professor. And I'd challenge them, or I'd say, that's the worst thing in the world. Some would say, all right, we're going to have a company with no more titles and no more desks and no more. And I'd sit there ready to push the button. Everyone's looking at me. I'd say, that's everything that's wrong. Right. You know, they go, what do you mean? I go, that's so ridiculous. You know, people want my office. That's why they come to work every day. They want to get to the top. You know, people want to move. People want to do things. And those that don't, it's okay because they've decided, okay, this is a good work-life balance for me. I'm going to, you know, I only want to get to here to make it germane to, since we're in a studio here, maybe somebody, you know, wants to dedicate a lot of time to being a musician. But like you said, you know, they still got to pay the mortgage. They got to do other things. So maybe they're working, but they're not taking on responsibilities or saying, okay, hey, I'm going to be the VP of the company and the, you know, CEO or whatever. No, I'll be cool. I'll work something more structured, get a nice pay, longevity, do the things I'm going to do. But I really enjoy my life doing this. You know, I'm spending 3, 4, 5 hours a day having a blast, doing this. This is what I want to do.
Right.
You know, this is what I want to do. And that's cool. Like, that's what life should be about. You know, I tell people this even the last few years. You know, my youngest girls, I have 3 girls, 2 boys, but my youngest are twin girls. You know, I like going to basketball practice with them. Like, you know, I enjoyed it. You know, it's cool. You know, did I enjoy Newport and, you know, having a blast at a you know, rock show, whatever. Yeah, of course. You know, I love it. I love Newport. I love the music scene. But, you know, there were times when also, okay, I need a break for a little bit. You know, I'm going to do this instead, you know, and it's going to be a good time. And I enjoy it. And same thing now. I never thought I'd, you know, I was never that kind of parent to go to every sports game and this and that. But for the last year and a half, I have been. You know, my son Tommy's playing football and basketball and other things. And, like, I enjoyed it. You know, and he played quarterback last year, Pop Warner. I'm like, wow, and what a different feeling seeing your son play quarterback. Like, I actually, you know, wrote a post that way. Not that every other position wasn't cool and all that. Yeah, I'm just saying, hey, by the way, this was really cool. Like, I never saw this in my life. Like, you know, I was the kid. My parents wouldn't even know what team I was on. So it was, you know, it's just a different feeling. And see my son Connor, I mean, he's got a really cool thing. Actually, you should look it up.
Yeah.
It's called BeatGig. Oh, BATGIG. Okay. BeatGig.com.
Local or?
No, nationwide. Check it out. He puts together venues with gigs.
Very cool.
And they started out as a concept, college fraternities, sororities who had budgets. Mm-hmm. They had they said, you know what? We're making transactions in the back of the house here, trying to get this guy to play for a couple $1,000s. Instead, now they're doing deals, $10,000, $20,000, $25,000. People showing up, parties, whatever, and they all transact on the platform. You can post your yourself, your band, whoever the artists are, and then they match them up. You can book your own show. They can book it in different places. Awesome stuff. Just awesome stuff. But, you know, my son Connor started going to School of Engineering, you know, at James Madison. Mm-hmm. Still finished, but I'll never forget. Orientation. We sat there. They were talking about some new majors. One of them was called Intelligence Analysis. I'm like, Connor, man, that sounds pretty good. I think I would do something like that. Really? Yeah. That's the future. Probably get a security clearance, too. Do it. Okay. Sure enough, graduated with that. My daughter graduates a couple weeks, May 19th, from RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, up in Rochester. Excuse me, in Troy. This is Rochester. Troy, New York. And, you know, what's her major? Design, innovation, and society.
Right.
You know? Unbelievable.
Looking forward, not looking at the standard issue.
Her internship, they grew, they you know, having gardens growing on rooftops and skyscrapers, you know?
And just, that's the kind of stuff you want to see here in
have
Rhode
to.
Island.
You have to. No. Listen, man, the top 10 jobs that are being listed going forward, one of them is going to be drone traffic controller. And you look back and you say, well, what is that? And what do you mean? You better learn what it is. And by the way, it makes sense. And why do I know? I live it. I actually have people, because of, you know, my business experience, they always ask me for advice. I have young guys who are like, hey, so we started this thing and we're going to be moving product from Point Judith over to Block Island. And we did surveys and we did all the things that, you know, and thank you for giving us advice. And we're doing this. And that. So we found out that medication is number one request on Block Island. This thing. And they take a ferry and they flew the drone and with the ferry and it takes this much. It has to be this far off the water and it's got to do this and it's going to be delivering things. And then just imagine no more, you know, ferry rides if you need sweet corn from whatever farm. You know, this thing's just going to bring it, okay? And it's a fact. It's just a fact. You can't be blind. You know, and those that might want to, you know, criticize me for being too futuristic or speaking too... Listen, you have to lay the foundation. You have to do it. You can't be that far after the fact.
That's kind of what we're dealing with now with marijuana in Rhode Island, where Mayor Herow in Attleboro is about to open. Well, he's not doing it personally, but he announced they're going to open 5 recreational marijuana stores. All of that revenue is going to leave Rhode Island and go to these stores. I know that's a touchy issue for some people, but for some people, it also is just an unbelievably ridiculous thing that it is an issue at all. And it plays itself out as well financially when you look at what's lost.
Well, I think what's frankly lost in that whole argument, and I just happen to see it from a different angle as well because of, you know, my business background and others, opportunities that have been presented to me over the years and, you know, friends and other businessmen that I've seen actually build companies and are building companies in that field is really the whole apparatus. You know, you can actually see a facility that looks like a farm, you know, and see, so for the, you know, the voter, they might just see the retail component of it and just try and understand, okay, how does this fit into my life and how will it impact? But the reality is there's just a whole industry that is, you know, again, it goes back to blockchain, other things. When you have industries that are, you know, being assembled, you have to pay attention to it. You know, you have to see who's involved. Why is it an opportunity as a state? How do we deal with it? But I've always said, you know, the liquor industry is always going to be against the marijuana.
Of course.
I think personally the liquor industry, you know, you're not going to spend $200 at a bar tab anymore. Why would you do that if you're having fun doing something else? You know, it's just the reality. And I know we look at it only from the medicinal purposes, but the reality is you're going to have recreational as the main conversation shortly in any of the legislative processes that are going to be before any decision maker. You know, that's really where it's all going. So you have to decide, you know, is it this or is it that? And then when we get there, because if it gets to the latter, the former doesn't even matter.
Right.
So, you know, we're dealing again with issues, controlling, figuring things out. And, you know, it's all about the mighty dollar, unfortunately, sometimes that drives decisions. And rather than common sense, and, you know, I'm just a believer that we have too many laws and we need to stop making laws. And so for me, anytime that we, you know, have bills that criminalize or make, you know, further situations where people pay fines or are confined or anything like that, I'm just against all that. You know, one of the big things that I'll deliver in my next set of Rhode Island papers will be how to deal with mass incarceration. That's really what needs to be dealt with.
I look forward to reading that very much. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Bill. I mean, this is a great environment. Again, congratulate you for, you know, A, putting something like this together, B, for, you know, extremely, you know, well thought out, intelligent questions. I think it's a nice forum for me and many other candidates to be able to kind of just sit down in a relaxed environment and just, you know, talk for a while and, you know, rather than get that, you know, 2-minute clip in and try and, you know, be processed.
I've tried to do as well is not turn it into a debate show. I'm just here listening. You know, I'm truly, you know, not trying to have an opinion. You know, I'm hoping that's the perception out there is I'm just trying to get the each person to sort of unload who they are for us.
I think you're doing a great service doing it that way because, you know, the got you days and the quick, you know, the setup questions, all that stuff. The problem is, you know, when you have set time frames and that's all you're talking about, you're not really understanding what the person's qualifications are and what are they going to do if they get elected. So, you know, again, we have a process that needs to be looked at in the future. And you really got to understand if people are qualified, you know, and I hope that just based on what I said earlier, if you're voting for someone who actually wants to take you somewhere, and I have the three paths that I'm focused on, which is education, employment, and retirement, they all end up in the same place. It's prosperity, I say, right? And what's that mean is up to you. Like, you can create whatever that means, but you're going to be on one of those. And then the rest of the people we have to take care of, right? We talked about those that are going to need support on both ends, the elderly on the younger side and those that, you know, have various needs. But everybody else, they should be on one of those paths. And that's why I mentioned that mass incarceration, because we have systems in place that don't get somebody on a path. And if they don't get on one of those three paths, then they have no path. And so we have to address that. And I'll be dealing with it in a very dramatic way. But, you know, thanks again for the forum. But the leadership, I can't stress it enough. You know, I'm someone who, you know, is like every other person. You have dreams, you daydreams, you think about things at night, you're stressed. You're happy, you're, you know, whatever you go through emotionally. I'll never forget. I was in second grade. I went to open house, whatever they call it now, parent-teacher conferences. And there I was interpreting for my parents. You know, I've led my family since the time I was 7 years old. And I have a brother who's 5.5 years older than I am. You know, and he's an awesome person and he's a hard worker. But there are people who just built a certain way. And I'm that guy, and I'm telling you right now, I will change Rhode Island forever. I'm going to change your life. I'm going to change everybody's life because it's time. We're just in that iteration. It's just that next natural step, you know, and we'll get there. Thanks again.
That's all for this edition of Bartholomew Town. If you like what you've been hearing, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform. You can also follow me on Twitter at Bill Bartholomew. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk soon. The day I turned away, I didn't know. I shot her in the glow. Through a blistered heart, an opening. A function of the sting.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.